Welcome to Why Do We Do That? A psychology podcast that deconstructs human behavior from the perspectives of social scientists, psychologists, and others that use applied psychology in their work. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Moyer. In this episode, I sat down with Professor of Psychology, Dr. Chris Ferguson, to talk about video games and their impact on aggression and mental health. Chris earned his PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Central Florida and is currently a faculty member in the psychology department at Stetson University. In 2013, he was awarded a Distinguished Early Career Professional Award from the Media Psychology and Technology Division of the American Psychological Association. He is also the co-author of Moral Combat: Why the War on Violent Video Games is Wrong. One of my main takeaways from my conversation with Chris is that we have to be cautious when we look to blame media exposure on negative mental health outcomes or broad societal problems. As Chris points out, each generation has its own technological boogeyman, and the panic that develops around these new forms of media tends to be overblown. Psychology is a scientific discipline, meaning that when we tell ourselves a story about human behavior, such as playing violent video games makes kids more likely to be violent in real life, we have to withhold judgment until we can investigate these ideas scientifically. Sometimes our common sense can be misleading, and without a strong data-driven story, our solutions may do more harm than good. Additionally, as someone who does not play a lot of online games myself, my chat with Chris also quelled some of my fears that online gaming is negatively affecting the social lives of young people. While excess gaming is likely to have some downsides, many online games incorporate live coordination that blends goal-oriented teamwork with casual banter. For some, this opportunity to socialize online may have a net positive effect, especially if the alternative is no social contact at all. The relationship between technology, phones, gaming, and social media is a hot-button issue right now, given the declines in youth mental health over the last 15 years. I hope that our discussion gives you some new information to chew on or challenges some of your pre-existing beliefs. Enjoy. Okay, today I am joined by Chris Ferguson. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's really awesome to be here. I appreciate it.
Now, you are a researcher who has spent a large portion of your career looking at the relationship between video games and behavior, amongst other things that you've researched. That's been one of your focuses. Mm-hmm. And you've argued that the negative impacts of video games in terms of how they impact aggressive behavior, that these impacts have been, generally speaking, highly overblown.
Yeah.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions about the impacts of gaming on behavior?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so I've been doing this for about 20 years now. It keeps me off the street, I guess. I think when I was first starting to do this about 20 years ago, the big concern then was this idea that like violent video games were going to cause aggression or violence. Whenever it was entirely clear what people meant sometimes by some of these terms, but at the very extreme, that like school shootings and other mass homicides were due, at least in part, due to violent video games. And so you would see these like the Columbine and Virginia Tech and these kind of like, you know, high profile school shootings being linked to video games. Now, whether they were or weren't, you know, is we could talk about that maybe. But certainly there was this public idea that there was this kind of link between these phenomena. And there were a lot of attempts by states to regulate the sale of violent video games to minors, all of which failed on legal grounds. So that was like a big concern at that time. And it's really kind of fascinating to think about that, like historically, right? Because now relatively few people talk about that anymore. That issue has kind of died away. I mean, some people still bring it up, of course. It's not completely gone, but the intensity of that debate has really subsided from 20 years ago. And now, like, the focus is on, what is being colloquially called addiction. I'm not really wild about that term myself, but the idea that games or social media or other screens, have this kind of, problematic usage, issue. So that's really, I think, the kind of the main focus a lot of people have right now. And I think social media is actually eclipsing video games even for that.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me the narrative around the school shootings, that was definitely overblown. There an earlier episode of this podcast, I spoke with an expert on school shootings, and what the general public fails to realize is that when you have something so rare as a mass shooting at a school, that it's actually kind of absurd to try to mathematically predict these things, especially when you have this sort of just so story of, well, why would anyone do this? They must have gotten the idea to do this from some sort of fantasy game or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is this, like, kids are empty vessels that are being filled by, whatever they see. And, it's very, and I understand it. I mean, it's at least, there's a kind of a vague theory behind it, which maybe is more than what we can say about the social media panic right now. But there is this kind of, like, naive view of childhood as if, like, children are innocent and blank slates, and that, whatever they see shapes their personalities in very predictable ways. And particularly if the thing they're seeing is morally naughty, then that's going to make them morally naughty is sort of the implication that we see with a lot of these things. So some people refer to this as, like, spun glass theory, the idea that, like, children are spun glass and that they have to be protected from anything lest they become, psychopaths or mentally ill or whatever kind of outcome we're worried about. And and there's, like, a good news and bad news story on this. And the good news is actually, like, kids are actually pretty resilient for the most part, and people are not in any way easily shaped, even by things we want to shape them. You know what I mean? So people are bad learners, for the most part. Maybe that's the bad side of it too. But in terms of, like, being exposed to these sort of, like, morally negative things, people don't really, and kids don't really learn from them in terms of mimicking the behavior very readily. The other side of it is, of course, that this whole, like, angelic, naive view of childhood is completely wrong. And children are little monsters, that they're actually, like, little, they have no empathy, when they start off, or very, very little. And so, kids don't need to learn to become aggressive. They need to be socialized out of it, not socialized into it. I think this whole idea that, like, children are innocent, angelic vessels of purity, is itself kind of a mistaken impression that is why people think that, like, yeah, like, these two kids in Columbine must have started in this default innocent position, and the only way we can explain why they became violent psychopaths is through some kind of malign cultural influence. Whether that's video games or social media or going back in time, comic books, Dungeons and Dragons, rock and roll, the radio, whatever other thing people were worried about at a given time. So that's kind of where this came from.
I like how you said that sort of the default for children is lack of empathy, which is, that seems to be the case. You need to build empathy and sort of beat out the selfishness. Nope, not literally beat out, but you really have to work hard to get them to be cooperative and not so selfish. But so on that line, part of me thinks that children, for the most part, move past that selfish phase. And my concern would be, what if you take a child whose empathy development is not going as smoothly as it should be, and then you mix in hours and hours of gaming, which, if it's a violent video game, because a lot of the fun ones are, that there's this sort of an interaction where children that don't have empathy to begin with will never pick it up if they start to spend too much time playing these violent yeah. games. That's, of course, that's just my made up story, but what are your thoughts on that?
I like your idea of beating empathy into kids, by the way. I like, you know, come here, kid, I'm going to smack some kindness into you, you know, sort of thing. But I mean, so this is like the, you know, the vulnerable population argument really is kind
yes.
of what
you're yes.
referring to. Yeah. And of course, that's an empirical, again, it's not an unreasonable hypothesis. And it's, you know, an empirical question, right? You know, it's, you know, can you provide some evidence for it? We can speculate until the cows come home about, you know, this group or that group or whatever. And really it just becomes that, you know, we need to actually show some evidence to support this hypothesis or whatnot. And, you know, and what you tend to see is, of course, you know, kids start from a relatively non-empathic, you know, position. And to test this, all you need to do is take like 10 preschoolers and put them in a room together and throw in one candy bar and lock the door and see how many survivors you have, you know, at the end of this, you know, particular experiment, you know, and so basically across, you know, really kind of like the late elementary and in through the teenage years, you see the sort of development of empathy in a relative state. Now, I also don't want to be puritanical or not puritan, maybe like, Pollyannish, you know, about adults either, because I don't think even adults' natural state is empathic. That a lot of the things we do that even signal empathy is really still selfish, you know, that it's all about status seeking and such. But nonetheless, I mean, certainly, you know, adults are more empathic than teenagers, and, you know, late teenagers are more empathic than early teens. And, right. and it is a thing that sort of develops, you know, fairly naturally across, you know, the lifespan. So, you know, what if you have someone that's like antisocial? What if you have a kid who has conduct disorder, you know, is really with the empathy just isn't developing even to the degree we might limited degree we might expect in normal developmental, you know, courses. And we do actually have a number of different tests of vulnerable populations. So myself and Cheryl Olson, you know, have done a few data sets where we've looked at kids that have a variety of different sort of pre-existing mental health problems, including things like, you know, conduct disorder, but also ADD or depression, and even looking at how they combine, you know. And what, of course, you find is that if you take conduct disorder kids and you also add in depression, that's a pretty bad mixture, right? You know, that you want to, as I sometimes say flippantly, you want to keep your psychopaths happy if you can. But when you add video games into this mixture, you don't see any more predictive value for adding violent video games into this whole thing. You know, so yes, absolutely, antisocial kids have more problems with, you know, antisocial behavior, not a shocker, you know, lack of empathy, things like that. But it doesn't matter whether they play a lot of violent video games or not. So you don't see any, or same thing with the ADD kids or the you know, depressed alone kids or that sort of thing. There's also, you know, another study looked at like autism in young adults, and this was from the University of Missouri, and that was, I don't think they came out and said this, but it was sort of prompted by the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012, where the shooter in that case, you know, was, I think, pretty conclusively demonstrated to have an autism spectrum disorder. But, you know, so there again, this was with young, like college age young adults, and they compared college age young adults with high functioning autism versus, you know, sort of those without any autism spectrum disorder, randomized them to, this was an experiment, randomized them to play a violent video game or a non-violent video game. Basically, neither group showed any effect from playing the violent video game. So again, it didn't matter if they had an autism spectrum disorder or not, the violent video games had no effect on them. So, I mean, the basic answer is, you know, that it's a reasonable, you know, thing to raise as a question, no doubt about it. But, you know, at this juncture, the evidence doesn't really support the idea that there's this kind of like vulnerable population of kids that, you know, there are kids that have problems with empathy, but it doesn't seem to be something that video games are contributing to in any meaningful way.
It seems to me that at the broader levels, that some of the debate centers around how you measure these outcomes of aggression.
Yeah.
Brad Bushman, who you've exchanged some writing with online,
yep.
In an earlier episode of this podcast on aggression, you know, basically flat out said that there is this link between video games and aggression. And as I've done a small amount of research, what I've noticed is that this, how you define the outcome, is important. So on if you're trying to measure aggression, on one hand, you could say, well, will video games lead to you, you know, a mass shooting in a school, the most extreme outcome? Probably not going to find any effects there.
Yeah.
Then as you work your way to a more mild outcome, you end up getting, you know, does it impact aggressive behavior? Like, are you getting into fights? Do you have conduct disorders? And then as you get even more down the line, you get to in a laboratory setting.
Yeah.
You say you have an artificial way of measuring aggression. He talks about this hot sauce paradigm that has been used. Could you please explain how the choices around how you measure aggression may or may not have made this such a difficult thing to talk about?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, unfortunately, we can't have people knife each other in the lab, right? You know, so there are these namby-pamby IRB things that get in our way from doing all the fun stuff, right? You know, so we're really kind of limited to what we can have people do in experimental, you know, design. Now, in terms of like survey-based research, or, I mean, you can look at like arrest records, you can look at, you know, diagnosis of like conduct disorder as an outcome. You can ask people, you know, hey, you know, have you murdered anybody? True or false? You know, so you can kind of like adequate people lie, you know, but you can look at different types of outcomes that are much more extreme with any kind of correlational approach, right? You know, but you can't have people actually injure each other in the lab, because it's both unethical and, of course, illegal to do this. You'll get sued for sure. You know, maybe, I don't know, I always joke, maybe in Russia you can get away with something like this, but, you know, not in the US anyway. So we are very limited, you know, in terms of what we can do in a laboratory setting. And so we do have these variety, and, you know, most of us on sort of both sides of this controversy have used kind of the same measures, and you know, so there's the hot sauce one is kind of like literally what it sounds like. You're invited to give a certain, you know, level of spicy hot sauce to someone in their sandwich who you think doesn't like spicy food. There's a noise burst one, which is just, you know, you give different loudness noise bursts to someone that, you know, you're playing a reaction time game against. If they lose, then they get these bursts of annoying white noise. And, you know, there's an ice water one where you like just literally put some sand in a bucket of ice water, you know, and then you get to decide how many seconds, you know, they have to keep their hand in the bucket of ice water, you know. And these things, I mean, you know, I don't want to throw out like the baby with the bathwater with these, or the ice water in this case, maybe. I think they can be kind of useful, you know. But I mean, as you say, I mean, some of the problems are that one, this isn't like what society's worried about, right? I mean, we're not worried about like the gangs of Chicago running around with wasabi sauce, trying like, you know, make each other's sandwiches more, you know, eye-watering or that sort of thing, right? You know, so there is a big gulf between these sort of like aggression measures and like crime or bullying or aggression in schools or things like that that we're actually, you know, concerned about. And they're also, they're like, we're actually telling people it's okay to do this, right? Which is different from like aggression in real life, where we're telling people it's not okay to do it, right? You know, right. So there's that conceptual problem is, okay, we're inviting people, go give them the hot sauce, right? You know, go give them the burst of, not, you know, it's okay. I'm the authority and I'm telling you it's okay to do it. And the other problem with a lot of these measures that has arisen is that they're not standardized, which means that people can extract aggression from them in multiple ways. I think with the noise burst one, it turns out there's something like 150 different ways to extract aggression from it. So you end up with this issue, you know, I don't know if your listeners would be familiar with the idea of like p-hacking, right? You know, the idea that you can pick and choose the outcomes that support your hypothesis and ignore the outcomes that have not. So, you know, there have been some papers that have been retracted in this field because essentially they've been accused of p-hacking. There also are a relatively limited number of what we call pre-registered studies. So again, it's a little bit inside baseball, but this is a method that researchers can use to sort of publicize in advance, you know, their analysis plan and their experimental plan, so that they can't fudge the data later on to try to, like, you know, torture the data to support their hypotheses. And even with these measures, you know, these kind of like hot sauce and noise bursts and ice water things, Which really, I mean, you're trying to think, like, what do they actually predict? I would say this is like April Fool's Day prank level aggression. We're not talking about like bullying. We're talking about like it's April Fool's Day, and you put the rubber band around that little shooter thing on your faucet, so your mom gets splashed in the face when she turns on the faucet. So which can be very funny to do, but it's not, she's not going to go to the hospital as a consequence of this, right?
So now,
And
but it sounds like what you're saying is that we haven't seen, in terms of the paradigms that we use to study the links between video games and aggression, we haven't seen something reliable. Do you think that's the same as there is a link between violence and video games? It's just we haven't quite been able to have the resources and energy to measure it properly? Because it sounds as like those are two sort of different criticisms or critiques of the relationship between video games and violence.
No, I think this is pretty much, I mean, I hate to say it feels dead, but, I think we beat this horse to death at this point. If there was something there, we'd have found something, somewhere in here. So we do have a relatively, maybe like, somewhere between a dozen to two dozen pre-registered studies of these aggression measures. And I think none of them have found any effect so in terms of like the replication crisis in psychology and trying to fix that, so this is starting to look like a lot of other fields of psychology that are part of this, false positive, that a lot of badly designed studies
Right.
found effects, but when you actually are more rigorous, you don't see the effects. So at this point, I would say, certainly acknowledging in the past there were these sort of mixed findings, but once you get to the pre-register studies, I think we're seeing a lot more consistency that we're just, I don't think, maybe one, some, yeah, I don't want to say for sure zero, but pretty close to zero. I found any evidence for any kind of effects, even on these very weak, kind of laboratory aggression measures. And the same thing when you look at like longitudinal studies of like surveys with kids looking at like conduct disorder or arrests or things like that. We're just not seeing, much of anything there. I mean, I'm very open to like the new mousetrap that is somehow, a genius study that's very looks at this in a different way, as long as it's pre-registered.
Right.
Yeah, no, I just, after, like I said, it's probably been like 40 years people have been looking at this in various ways, and then you can look at like the data on mass shooters themselves. You can look at, the international, what countries have more crime versus play more video games. You can look at the US crime rate versus video game consumption. So we have data in other places too. And all the data is basically converging to suggest that, at very least, this is probably something we can let go. It's not a major concern, and it's time to move on to, poverty or like homelessness or something like
Right.
that. Probably is a bigger concern that we should spend more time on.
So obviously some of the most popular video games are violent in nature. This has been the case for quite some time. What is it about the act of engaging in violence in this artificial setting that is so attractive to humans?
Well, I mean, I think we're a violent species. I mean, if you look at us, both in terms of like the evolutionary history and the archaeological history, or even just the history, right? You can see this, very, very clear pattern of humans being an aggressive and a violent species, just like chimpanzees. I mean, I don't know if there's any mystery to how this happened. And so it's been, sort of adaptive. It's not maybe not morally desirable, but it's been adaptive to at least have some level of aggression, both as individuals and as a species. And so I think that's sort of wired in. It's not very flattering of us to say this, right? But I think that is kind of I kind of like tell my students sometimes, if you just sort of like understand that the default position of humanity is actually kind of bad, then like history makes a lot more sense. Like why do we keep fighting wars? Why did like most cultures enslave people? This kind of stuff. Why do most cultures treat women so poorly? This kind of, It's like, well, but if you think that like people are basically good, that it doesn't make any sense. You'd like think there's some sort of corrupting influence. If you realize people are just basically bad, then it's like, well, people are just doing what people do. And then it makes a hell of a lot more sense. So I think that reflects, and of course, if you look at like who's more physically aggressive, men or women, then it's clearly men. Now women are aggressive in other ways, like social aggression. So I think if you look at who likes violent video games, or violence or aggressive sports or other sorts of things, that it's men. I mean, I think if you sort of remove the cultural taboos around it, and you told a group of men that they could watch a bunch of other men, fight with swords and kill each other, they would. They absolutely would,
Right, right.
today, and so I think that interest in that stuff is just hardwired, into our species. Now, most of us would not like to be directly involved in it, because we understand that there are high risks of death or injury to be involved, in that stuff. But the inclination to kind of be on a side or on a in a tribe, so I think drives everything from like sports, to enjoying violent video games, to the way people behave in politics, to the way people behave on social media, all this kind of stuff that they all kind of reflect, who we are as a species, maybe not very flatteringly. But I just think it's innate because violent video games aren't popular just in the US. I mean, they're popular in Mexico, they're popular in China, they're popular in Africa, they're
Right.
popular everywhere. Just men and some women, just love to play them. And I think it speaks to just this intrinsic, element of our wiring that we like aggression. We like to compete with other groups. We like to win. And at this point, most of us, however, would like to not get killed or injured in the process of doing it. So we'd rather watch someone else do it,
Right.
So whether that's football, I mean, I would get murdered if I tried to actually play football, right? I get I'm closer in size to the ball than I am to most of the other players, right? And same thing with like war. War is interesting. I love watching war films. I love World War II history, World War I history, right? I don't want to go to war, but I still have that wiring of, and I don't want people like in real life to die in wars or whatever, but I still find watching it, to be very, very interesting. And I think that's just part of, it's just like chimpanzees. So the two male chimpanzees fight, all the others gather around to watch. So I think it's still that inclination.
So if we are going to assume that if you look for violent behavior as a consequence from playing video games as something that is put to rest, that there's probably no link. Let's talk a little bit about some other potential psychological impacts from gaming, because there you could make the case that there are other ways that gaming might influence one's psychology or one's behavior. I'm particularly interested in this escapism aspect of playing a game. A lot of my students, they kind of report in their writing that they like the escapism. In many cases, their real life is not great, and the game provides an escape. I'm curious as to your thoughts as to, do you think that there is a, let's just say, a potential downside to using gaming as escapism, in the same way that any sort of heightened stimuli might dilute everyday life. So, for example, if you eat food that's too tasty, too sugary, too fatty, regular quote unquote food doesn't taste as good. If if you're a young man and you're watching, you learn about sex from watching a lot of pornography, and then you eventually engage in actual sex with someone, it might not be as stimulating. Do you think that that's one of those possible impacts of gaming, or even maybe it's excess gaming?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm definitely the guy who eats the rich foods of, donuts and Italian marinara and then, steaks and this kind of stuff. And, so I can sort of re relate to that. And then I hate vegetables. But, some people might say, well, you should really eat more vegetables. But, the reality is not that the problem is with the donuts and the steaks. It's that vegetables suck. And like, all kids know this, right? I mean, this isn't like an amazing insight on my part. It's like, it's taboo to say as adults, we're supposed to pretend that we like vegetables, but most of them stink. I mean, you can sometimes, sneak one in past me if it's like pureed and has a good cheese or sauce in it or something like that. But, so, and I think that's what happens with a lot of these things. So, I mean, actually, escapism isn't necessarily, bad. I mean, it is if you're just completely ignoring your problems and that sort of thing. But I mean, and there are different ways of like framing this. It's all about like how, what kind of work. So there's this like idea of like mood management, right? And basically the idea of mood management is if, if like life sucks, right? If you just had a bad day, that there is actually useful, to do something in order to improve our mood, right? So if we say, if you had a stressful day and you come home and you read a book, to escape it, like Harry Potter is like famous for this, right? To escape into this, fantasy world that, I'm a Harry Potter fan, a lot of people love it, or you go for a run, right? And you're just like, enjoying, I like to run. I also, yeah, I'm picking all my hobbies. I run too. So I'm trying to use that to offset the donuts I was just talking about. So if I'm like running, I like to run outside. Yeah, if I'm running outside in nature, then I'm sort of enjoying the peace and the tranquility and this in the, it's Florida, so there are ponds and all this kind of stuff, right? So I think we kind of like look at that and like, well, those are good things though, right? Because you're exercising or you're reading a book, and we value books and we value trees, and exercise and all this kind of thing. But if you do it with a video game, even if the outcome is the same, right? You're reducing your stress, you feel better, more positive, you've been able to sort of distract yourself from these sort of negative experiences of your real life. Then we kind of look at that as bad because we don't like video games, right? So I think I can you kind of think like, what's the difference between spending 3 hours reading a book versus, 3 hours playing a video game? And people might say, well, you become smarter reading a book. Well, you don't. If nobody's reading like Shakespeare. I mean, they're reading 50 Shades of Grey. That's not, it's going to subtract from your intelligence, if anything, or trees, you're getting more exercise. That's lovely. Of course, exercise is great. There's nothing like inherently bad about, spending time with a video game in order to do that, other than old people don't like it when kids do it, essentially. So I think for the most part, I mean, what we're really calling escapism is mood management, that people are kind of using these things that are hobbies. And whether you use knitting or video games or reading or exercise, or, you build model airplanes or trains in your garage or whatever, it doesn't really make a difference. For the most part, and it's generally a good thing. Now, I mean, of course, when any of these things become a problem, and that's true again for building the trains or playing the video games or even exercises, if you overdo it, right? And then you're not going to work, or you're not going to school, or you're not doing your homework, or you're ignoring your wife or your husband or your kids or something of that sort. So, I mean, all of these things can be overdone. But there again, and certainly some people do overdo video games, but there's nothing, inherently different about overdoing video games as opposed to overdoing exercise. I know people, including Abraham Maslow. I'm not accusing him of being an exercise addict, by the way, but he died on a jog, right? He had a heart attack and died at 62. So that makes me nervous because I jog and I'm 52. I only have 10 years left if I'm on his trajectory. So there are people that overdo exercise, shopping, eating, sex, work, but we don't complain about the work addicts, right? We complain about the video game addicts or whatever else. So there's a kind of like moral judgment, I think, around the eye, or porn. You mentioned porn in there, as well. I think it's the same thing there that some people overdo it, but there's nothing inherent about porn or video games that makes people overdo it, as opposed to, work or exercise or cats. I mean, you can Google cat hoarder, and find examples of people that overdo cats, but we should, I don't think we should ban cats. There are probably some people that think we should, but I'm not one of those.
Well, you did touch on something as you were kind of creating this landscape of all of the behaviors that people use to escape. Of course, there, yeah, there, it, we end up creating a difference in the sense that people are they will happily admit that it's okay to escape some ways and that they don't like that they're escaping other ways, like using hard drugs or something like that. What about what are your thoughts on this kind of shift towards adolescents getting more and more of their socialization online, in the sense that, outdoor play has sort of been on the decline for many decades, and many of my friends who are in their, you know, early 30s or so, a lot of them, you know, they have most of their friendships were developed through online play. Yeah. It wasn't just hanging out, you know, watching TV together. It's, you know, using a headset, playing a game together. Do you think that there are, before we get into some of the benefits of gaming, do you think that there are any potential issues with socializing mostly online?
Well, I think it's a complicated issue, right? And I don't think that there's like a utopia of kids like holding hands and dancing around a maypole or something like that. That is, you know, on the horizon anywhere. And a lot of it is like changes in parenting, right? You know, that, you know, on one hand, we've all been, and I have a 20-year-old son, so we've just sort of escaped this. You know, his behavior is on him now, not us. But no, he's a really good kid. He's doing really good. I was very aware of this as a parent. I think my wife was too, that, you know, and that's going to be one of these like back in my day stories, right? But like back when I was a kid, you know, as long as we navigated around the dinosaurs and stuff like that, right? You know, that my parents would like, okay, you know, off you go and make sure you're home by dinner. Whenever the hell that was, and that wasn't, they didn't even give us a time, you know. Whenever you're hungry, just show up again. It's like a, you know, having a, these would do the dogs back then too, right? You should be able to set your dog loose and then just, they would come back at some point. And that was kind of thing. Like, we just like go off and might, you know, we'd be like doing sometimes dangerous things. And my parents would have no idea where the hell we were, like climbing down a quarry or something like that, you know? And most of us would show up again, right? Some of us didn't, but most often the mortality rate was pretty low. And now it's like, if you let your kid out in the front yard by themselves, you're like a terrible parent, you know? And I remember this, like when my kid was really little, like literally having him play out unsupervised in the yard. It's like, you know, God, I hope the cops don't drive by, you know? Right. And so there's really been this kind of like, you know, and keep in mind, the world is actually much safer now than it was in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up. You know, the rate of like child kidnappings is so tiny, tiny, tiny. I mean, it does happen. But we've all been like, you know, for lack of a better word, like sensitized to this idea that there's like a looming disaster waiting around every, you know, palm tree for your kid. So I think we've all been kind of, so in other words, we're not letting our kids out of our sight anyway. Right. You know? And then also there's this pressure of like, you know, for a lot of parents that, you know, like if your kid doesn't go to Oxford, you're a failure, you know, as a parent, you know, so you need to make sure your kids are taking violin lessons and they're becoming Eagle Scout and they do karate and they, you know, can paint the Mona Lisa with their, you know, non-dominant hand, you know, or that kind of thing, you know, and there's, so we put a lot of pressure on kids to be part of these like organized activities, most of which they don't want to do. And at the same point, we don't let them, you know, out, you know, into the yard even, you know, let alone down the street, you know, to find some trouble because we were afraid of getting arrested, you know, and not like paranoid, because this has happened to some parents, right? You know, and then we're like, but it's the video games, you know, that what done it, you know, we really haven't given like kids any other, you know, option, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of like finding people, you know, to some degree. We've really kind of like created an environment where socializing in real life has become not impossible by any means, but certainly it's become more difficult than it was in the 70s and 80s. And also, I mean, in fairness to the kids too, I mean, sometimes it's easier to find people if your environment is the world and you have a particular interest, you know, like fantasy art role-playing games or something like that. Right. It's easier to find people that are on the same boat, you know, as opposed to being stuck with the, you know, I don't know, you know, 50 or so jerks in your class that happen to live in your neighborhood, you know, if you don't, you know, so I think it's easier to, if you have a niche interest in particular, it's easier now to find people that have that niche interest, but you have to do it through, you know, online environment. So, I mean, I think it's one of the things that, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm in no way downplaying like, you know, that, you know, having real life friends is great, you know, I, you know, and having a mixture of these is probably the ideal place to be. for most kids. There may be some kids who are really shy or who have autism spectrum disorders who may really benefit from online friendships.
Right.
And of course, during COVID, that was a special time. And, everybody kind of praised video games and even social media. It's hard to remember. It was only 4 years ago for letting kids socialize without, killing their grandparents, essentially. So I don't think it's necessarily terrible, but I think probably the ideal is to have some of both. For the median kid, at very least. But I think a lot of this gets mixed into this idea, and I hear this all the time of like parents saying, I wish my kid was outside looking at trees, And I think, like, do you remember being 14? Did you stand outside looking at trees? Just kids don't like doing this, sort of thing. This is a very like 52-year-old dude thing to want your kid to do. Anyway, so, again, if the kid is happy, if they're doing good in the school, if they're basically getting enough sleep, they're, your kid's fine. And they're getting neurotic about, well, too many of their kids are online, or too many of their friends are online. They have friends, and that's, better than not having any friends. So, you let some of the small stuff go, I think, a little bit. And that's just my perspective on it. But anyway.
Yeah. So, you mentioned the idea that the online gaming community gives both children and adults an opportunity to connect who might have very niche interests. Again, 50 years ago, you're not going to come across, it's going to be much more difficult to come across somebody with that shares your niche interests, whereas an online community, a little bit easier. Could you talk a little bit more about, as you see it, some clear-cut benefits that you might gain from gaming?
And in fairness, I think when we talk about benefits, if you kind of like went back to like the mid 2000s and such, I think you saw exaggerations in both directions, so there was this kind of like perspective that video games were clearly linked to aggression or school shootings or whatever. And on the other hand, you would get people like, this is going to turn your kid into a genius, sort of thing. Like, your kid's going to become an engineer or a surgeon because they played shooter games and like that. And like, no, I don't think the evidence is really good for that either. So I think a lot of the claims in kind of like both directions were, maybe a bit, exaggerated.
I'm worried. It's funny that you say that because I see my girlfriend has two kids and, I see them doing math games on the tablet. And part of me is, wow, this is awesome. Because they've gamified math. I didn't really have an opportunity to do that, right? But there's another part of me that's terrified that it's not a panacea. It's not something that is going to be the game changer for math education, even though that's what it's purported to be.
It's probably not. I mean, the one thing that you can say is good about like games and education is that games are good attention holders, right? They're not necessarily better teachers than like live human beings, but they are better attention holders. And I think that's kind of where education tries to use them. My kid, again, when he was little, he went to a summer camp, that was a Minecraft camp. He was really, really big into Minecraft at the time. And this Minecraft camp was like 2 weeks, and it was themed around the Underground Railroad, right? Kind of learning about the history of the Underground Railroad and slavery and all this kind of stuff. And I could tell you, my kid gave two shits about the Underground Railroad, essentially could care less about history, but he loved Minecraft, So in the context of like playing Minecraft for 2 weeks, he kind of like accidentally learned a bunch of stuff about the Underground Railroad, right? And that's kind of like the genius sometimes of using games in education. Now, of course, that's also a very limited piece of history. He didn't like become a historian, as a consequence of this, right? He learned a few berries. And I think if you asked him today, it's been probably 10 years later, have you heard of the Underground Railroad? He'd say, yes, it had something to do with slaves and slavery's bad. I think he had the gist of it, so you can, which, otherwise he would have fallen asleep, in a history class if he tried to do the same thing, because he, is not a person that intrinsically enjoys history, and that's fine. So I think you can get that, but I think, but like with your example of your girlfriend's kids, like, that's great that they're learning math and that's keeping their attention and doing it. You know, honestly, what are their odds of like designing the first like lander on Mars as a consequence of playing this video game? You know, virtually zero, you know, essentially, you know. So we just have to have, you know, this kind of like a, you know, modest understanding of what video games can do, even in a positive direction. I mean, they're fun. I mean, that's the big benefit, you know, right? You know, and you know, there's some evidence to suggest they might improve visual spatial cognition in some small ways, or that they may reduce stress, you know, in the same way that other hobbies do. There's nothing magical about them in that sense. You know, so if you like video games, then it may make, you know, as a lot of gamers have been saying for decades, if you like games, it makes you feel better. It makes you, you know, it reduces your stress, like any hobby. You know, people will talk about self-determination theory, which suggests that video games will help you get needs met that you can't get met in real life, including the social needs, which are the online stuff that we were talking about, but also competency and autonomy. So you can feel like you're good at something, or that you have the freedom to make decisions, which if you think about, like most the median person's job or going to school, the median student doesn't feel either of those things, right? They're told what to do, and they might feel mediocre at it, you know. So, you know, by contrast, you can go into like civilization and conquer the world, you know, and make a lot of decisions when you're doing that. So, I mean, I think the, you know, the really the benefit is that it's they're fun, and they're enjoyable. And I think, you know, rather than worrying so much about like, you know, my kid is 15 and wants to play Grand Theft Auto, am I going to destroy him? Or vice versa, you know, if I get my kid Tetris, is he going to become like a genius, you know, sort of thing? I think we can leave most of that stuff behind and say like these are games, they're fun, and they're just like other, you know, hobbies, and you can kind of perceive them that way. Just don't overdo it, and other than that, we don't need to worry about them for the most part.
So if this link between violence and gaming won't die, and you spend a lot of time kind of refuting these statements about the link, my last question is, where would you like to see research in gaming as it relates to psychology? Where would you like to see that go as a potential future direction?
I mean, I actually think it is dying. I mean, I think that, you know, the fears over video games, and even maybe some of the excitement over video games, is kind of dying off, you know, with time. And I think that's just generational. I mean, if you look back at like, you know, rock music, I mean, there were huge outcries over rock music in the 1980s, right? You know, or comic books in the 1950s, or the radio in the 1940s, but nobody worries about the radio or comic books or, you know, rock music today, you know. And I think video games are heading that same direction. And what happens is that we refer to these things as moral panics, right? And moral panics have an audience, and the audience is old people, you know. And increasingly, I'm becoming an old people, you know. So I'm not trying to like, you know, be ageist or anything. But what happens to that audience is because you just decided that you're going to pander to the old people because they buy newspapers and they vote and, you know, they have money for grants. Some of them do anyway. Is eventually your audience dies, right? It just literally is gone. And that's why, you know, people in the early 1990s were suing Ozzy Osbourne over, you know, suicide, like, you know, causing young men to commit suicide. Now the dude has Parkinson's disease, and if you go to like, you know, a concert for someone like Ozzy Osbourne, then the average age of the people at the concert is like 104. Right, you know what I mean? Like the audience of the scared people go away. You know, they're in the ground, you know, at some point. And I think that's already happening for video games. I think that's, you know, now we're seeing this transfer to social media. And you know, if you're gonna ask like, you know, where would I like to see the research go? I mean, kind of, I'd just say let's stop doing it, you know, to for the most part. That I think this is done, and we just keep repeating these expensive, stupid cycles with, you know, we're going to repeat it now with social media. And I can already tell you that the evidence for social media effects on mental health is not good. Then social media will go away, and then it'll be AI. And then it'll be something, and after AI, it'll be something else. There's always the looming disaster. And I kind of wish that, you know, we could have maybe smaller, smarter research paradigms that, yeah, I mean, it's worth asking the question, you know. So let's, you know, get a couple people who are maybe on both sides of this. They design a couple projects that are pre-registered and have clear, rigorous, you know, guidelines for what we'd expect to see if we were going to be worried about an effect. I think you then would do a couple studies and find pretty much nothing, and then we can move on. And that's probably how a media effects field should go. And I'd be putting myself out of business mostly by doing this if people actually did it. I wouldn't know what to do with my undergraduates because they all want to do media research. So it's so easy to bring people in the lab and have them play a PlayStation game for a while, right? And then get a pub out of it somehow. But I think, you know, we're circling our wheels at this point, that most of this stuff is just, you know, trying to convince a general public who are neurotic about these things that there's not so much to worry about. And we probably could do that quicker and cheaper if we had more rigor in our scientific fields, and also like very clear and high standards of evidence. And that's, I think, what we're really still lacking. We're getting the pre-registration right now. I think you're seeing more emphasis on sort of like the rigor in that sense. But I think in psychology in general, not just for video games or social media or that kind of stuff, still lacks rigor in terms of what we might call like effect size, right? You know, that we really, we're still at that point where I'm a little inside baseball and stats here. So I apologize to your listeners who are not statisticians, but we're still like champing at that P equals 0.05. And it's like a magic finish line if you can cross that. And we pay no attention really still to the magnitude of effect and the possibility that some tiny effects may be just noise as opposed to true effects. And I think that's, if I really had a message for like any like actual psychologists or other social scientists listening, is stop treating correlational coefficients of like 0.07 as if they meant anything at all. They don't support your hypothesis. Even if you reach a P of 0.05, stop it. You're hurting the world. You're making us all look stupid. Stop it. and that's really what I'd like to see just in general, you know, psychology and social science do is probably fewer studies overall, more rigorous studies, no more of these like 10-page literature reviews, you know, God, that's such a waste of time. And shorter papers, you know, more rigorous pre-registered designs, clear standards of evidence for effect size. And, you know, and accepting that means that a lot of the stuff we're going to do is going to be no results, essentially. And that's okay. But we should also publish those no results, right? You know, and then the world will be great and everybody will thank me and I'll be a millionaire.
And yep. And we can sit back, relax and play a game, chill out, not have to worry about any negative consequences.
Basically, yes.
Well, thank you so much for being on today. It was very enjoyable chatting with you, Chris Ferguson.
It's awesome being here. Thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
For more on Chris, follow him on X at CJFerguson1111 or check out his book, Moral Combat: Why the War on Violent Video Games is Wrong, wherever books are sold. If you enjoy this podcast, please share an episode with two of your friends. Head over to Patreon to become a paid supporter of the show. Follow the Why Do We Do That Facebook page for additional content. Don't forget to rate and write a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow on Instagram at Why Do We Do That Podcast or X at WDWDTpod. As always, feel free to email me with comments or guest suggestions at whydowedothatpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, this is Dr. Ryan Moyer, hoping you found some answers to the question, why do we do that?